Welcome to the Airport Lounge. I'm your host, Airport. This podcast is aimed at providing deeper insights into all things Web3, including the stories of prominent figures, builders, and community members generally operating in this space. My guest today is John HQ. John wears many hats, though he's best known in Web3 for his skills as a Discord server auditor and overall for being a Web3 and Discord safety guy. He's audited several huge Discord servers, including the server for Origins NFT, which is how I first heard of him. In this episode, we discuss John's story, as well as actionable tips for anyone in this space to stay safe. As always, nothing in this podcast should be construed as financial advice. Please do your own research fully before deciding to make any investments. And before we get into the podcast, I also want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, Origins NFT. Origins is a data analytics platform and community of NFT traders that I've been a part of since my time entering the Web3 and NFT communities. Anyone who's followed me on Twitter for some length of time will have seen me post the occasional Origins chart together with some analysis, and I often credit a lot of what I know and understand about markets and data-driven analytics to the Origins community. And truly, navigating this space is made a lot easier with a community of like-minded individuals. I've been a vocal supporter of Origins NFT for the longest time, and I do encourage anyone who's still looking for a community to navigate this space with to pop into the server, have a chat with me or any of the mods in the comments channel, and have a look around. Thank you, as always, to Origins for sponsoring this podcast. And without further ado, let's get into the episode with John HQ. Cool. All right. Thanks for coming on, John. I want to get right into it, actually, because I was just looking on your Twitter, and are you actually using Internet Explorer 4.1?
No, I am not. I did use it back in the day just because I was really interested in sort of old and antiquated software.
Yeah.
So, interestingly enough, I think that was the last version that was supported on Mac of Internet Explorer. And, you know, just to be cool and edgy, I installed it on a Mac computer that I was using at the time and kept bragging to my friends like, oh, you're using Chrome? It doesn't have a built-in stock ticker like Internet Explorer 4.1. But yeah, it was actually...
Does it actually have that? That's insane.
Yeah. Back in the day, it had a built-in stock ticker. It was lovely. I don't think it works anymore because I think the feed that they're using is long since dead. But it's the thought that counts. But it was actually really interesting because a lot of those early, like, 2000s browsers don't have, like, any modern standards or ability to render JavaScript or anything at all. So a lot of the internet just does not work for it. But it's just kind of fascinating. There's also a command line-based, I think it's Lynx. Yeah, Lynx browser, which is a command line based browser. So it renders websites entirely in text inside of your command line.
Oh my god.
And you can't really use anything on the modern web anymore with it. But it's actually kind of interesting because people make specifically websites that are built for like non-graphical web browsing. Which is actually kind of useful for people in other countries too who might be browsing like on limited cell phone connection.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I totally thought this Internet Explorer thing was real, and I thought it was like a security tip or something, and I was like, wow, I gotta stop using Chrome. I gotta start using old software, apparently. So
there is a concept in internet network security of like security through like it's kind of a different type of obscurity, it's actually kind of fascinating because like a lot of the United States, like, nuclear system is built on, like, floppy disks and really, really old hardware, simply because it's not networked at all, right? So you don't have to air gap it. It was built before networks were a thing. And then also, like, a lot of the banking infrastructure is built on COBOL, which, if you're a younger guy and you want to figure out what language you want to learn to become a programmer and make a lot of money, the guys who know COBOL are retiring and or dying. So getting a solid grasp of COBOL to keep a lot of these antiquated systems up and running actually can propel you out of college to a very, very high paying job potentially.
Oh, wow. That's the alpha of the day, I guess. Holy shit. Okay. Well, thank you for that tidbit. That's incredible. No, that's awesome. I'm fascinated by sort of how much you know about all this stuff. And remind me again, because we talked about this at the Origins thing, but you are a software engineer, software dev by trade, who found your way into crypto, right?
Nope. I'm a marketing guy.
Not at all. Marketing guy. That's right. I remember this. Yeah. But you were working with some kind of financial application. Is that right?
Yeah. So I've been involved in crypto since 2011. Mainly what I've loved doing, what I love doing still, is I love working with startups. The idea of creating something new, solutions to problems, getting something out there, even if it's super alpha, super early beta, makes me very excited. It's nice to actually, you know, build something from the ground up. So I've been working with startups, specifically with the cryptocurrency startups, for basically the last 11 years now. And I started actually way back in the day. I was working with a Bitcoin poker site, which was an interesting adventure. And that's actually how I got started in crypto and Bitcoin in particular, is I just wanted to play poker online. And there were no other options because that was pretty recently after poker's Black Friday incident. So I figured that there were probably other people in the United States who also wanted to play poker online, which it was not illegal to play poker online. It was simply impossible to transfer money to poker sites because the U.S. banking system wouldn't let you do it. So I got really fascinated with the solution that Bitcoin provided specifically for poker sites. So that was sort of my intro into the space. From there, I started working with a merchant that sold gold and silver for Bitcoin, and was actually one of two options in the United States to liquidate your Bitcoin. Essentially, you either could go to Mt. Gox or you could go and order some gold and silver and have it shipped to you, which then you could, you know, go and sell at a pawn store or whatever. So worked also that company was the one and only Mt. Gox verified merchant, which aged poorly. But that was a lot of fun. And that also gave me a lot of sort of introduction and networking opportunities in the space. Because there weren't a whole lot of Bitcoin merchants out there, so it was a good opportunity for me to really get involved with the rest of the community. Which, after that, I did Bitcoin Black Friday, which was just a collection of merchants selling things on Black Friday for Bitcoin. Worked for Ripple in 2013 I was basically helping them out on the community side, and with the stated goal of making Bitcoiners hate Ripple less. So I think I failed my job duty, but...
I was going to say, how's that going for you, John?
But it was a really good opportunity, and it kind of broadened my horizons a little bit, because I was a Bitcoin maxi for pretty much all of those years leading up to that. From there, I worked with a Bitcoin payment processor, which kind of got me involved more on sort of the exchange side. And then... sort of my last Bitcoin gig, I worked with Bitflyer, which was a Japanese Bitcoin exchange, and they were opening up an exchange in the United States. So I helped, you know, build out the U.S. office and go through the entire process of actually creating a Bitcoin exchange in the United States, which was a really, really good experience. And then with that, I ended up doing a lot more work on the business development side and trying to build out order book liquidity for an exchange, which was an interesting problem to learn about and try and solve. But yeah, so that's my background. Like, I, again, all over the place, but really my only sort of background in software development is just the fact that I've been involved in crypto for so long, and whenever I see something, I just want to play with it, right?
Yeah.
So more of a hobbyist than someone who does it as a trade, but...
That's incredible. I think that's... It's an interesting thing, right? Because I think it is one of those types of things where people like yourself who get really interested in things and get really into stuff that they're doing, you know, kind of find this space almost by accident. And then it's like, oh, you know, this is part of me now. This is like part of my life, you know, and it just becomes such a thing. But it's amazing how active you are. And I think even, you know, as far back as 2011, I mean, I still remember when I was in school at the time. So I was in university. And back then, it was a thing of, you know, people were talking about, oh, you should buy crypto, you should, you know, buy just like a dollar of, you know, Bitcoin or something, you know, like $100 worth of Bitcoin. And people were, you know, making a really big thing out of this, but it was just so hard to even buy, you know, cryptocurrencies. Like, it wasn't as easy, you know, certainly not as easy as it is today. And even today, people think it's difficult enough.
In the early days, it was like, use this sketchy Russian payment system to send some rubles to this guy, and we totally promise he'll send you some Bitcoin, which was interesting. Actually, I purchased my first Bitcoins on a now defunct exchange called EXCHB way back in the day. But that wasn't too bad. I think it was just a money order that I had to do because they were US based before the government really even specified if exchanges needed licensing at all. It was a very confusing time because no one knew really anything, right? When I started in crypto, like I was entirely anonymous because I was like, oh, what if the US government like cracks down on this? And very few people were of the opinion, oh, it's probably going to be until like, you know, 2015 before the US government even starts to notice that crypto's a thing.
Right.
So it was a lot of uncertainty in those days.
No, I'm sure. And I mean, I think that's, you know, why I guess people who were early adopters, you know, were rewarded handsomely, obviously, when things did go well, because obviously there was that risk that, you know, it could have just fizzled into nothing. It could have been, you know, regulation could have come in to stop the whole thing. And, you know, obviously, as you mentioned with the Poker Black Friday thing, like, obviously, that was a big shock for everybody. You know, as far as I'm aware, what happened with that was just, you know, a lot of the poker online poker websites being shut down. And I think the only there's still one or two that operate in the US, or are they completely gone now?
Well, the interesting thing is pretty much every major poker site online at this point is accepting Bitcoin or some type of cryptocurrency. It's incredibly easy to fund any poker account with crypto at this point. And, you know, it's helpful also because cryptocurrency has at least gained recognition or at least limited adoption in pretty much every country in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which makes it a lot easier to convince a platform to accept it as a funding option.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, actually. That's an interesting real life application that I never really thought about, but that's a fascinating one. So how did you find your way to Discord security? Because that's sort of how I first heard of you, and it's just amazing to me again, because you know, you wear so many hats and you're very knowledgeable in many things, but I always saw you as the Discord security guy, and people are always saying, you know John HQ, he's the guy you go to if you need a Discord server audited. So how did that whole thing start?
I used to be in the right click save crowd on NFTs, not gonna lie. But a buddy of mine who wasn't really involved too much in crypto eventually was just like, hey, there's this project called the Pudgy Penguins. You should join their mint. And I was like, no, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen in my life. and then, you know, I saw that it went really well and they got like some good news coverage and the floor price started pumping. And I was like, OK, this is a little bit interesting. The next project that he sold me on was JPEG's Automart, which is a collection of pictures that are photoshopped of 2007 Kia Sedonas. Which, out of all the projects that I have participated in at this point, that project still has the best memes and the best just absurdist content of any project that I've ever seen in the space, and still have not seen any other project overcome sort of just the craziness of their lore. And it's very well produced too. But I basically bought my first NFT from that collection and just started looking at like the marketplace on OpenSea. And it was actually really fascinating to me because it reminded me of, you know, video games, you know, like the RuneScape marketplace or trying to find a good lobby in Diablo 2 to shift some runes. So like that aspect of having a super inefficient marketplace that really is participated by only with humans made me very, very excited, because I've done, you know, a good amount of crypto trading, but I've always sort of felt outmatched because essentially everyone who makes a good amount of money, good amount of profit trading actively in crypto is using bots. Like, you have to. But in the case of an NFT marketplace, especially with a project that has recently minted, there is not really good information about what what traits, what attributes of an NFT are going to be the most popular, the most valuable. So you actually have to have a good amount of human judgment sort of built into your trading strategy to do well in NFTs, which basically just hooked me. So I started participating in a lot more projects. And at that point, I realized that every single project that I joined with the Discord was just set up terribly. The reason I knew is because I am also pretty much a Discord native. I started using it pretty recently after it came out, like back in like 2014 or something.
Oh, wow.
And I play a lot of video games, and I play a lot of hardcore, very competitive video games that are usually player versus player. And the end result of that is there are a lot of players who try and get any advantage that they can get, including, you know, compromising an enemy group's Discord and getting information and intel that way. So back in like 2017, I actually snagged someone's Discord token. They gave it to me, right? Like, I told them, like, hey, I need your Discord token to check something. And they just gave it to me. They didn't understand that by giving me the Discord token, I could see every channel and every server that they were in. And from that, I was able to gain an advantage on his group and ended up destroying like 50 of their bases from cords that I got from him.
Oh my God.
So like, that was my introduction to Discord tokens and how dangerous they are. But just from using Discord so much and having people like who actively try to infiltrate or attack just gaming Discords that I was in, when I started joining these NFT servers, I would be like, guys, like, I can right-click and create a thread in your announcements channel. That's not good. And about that time, when I was just getting started in NFTs, is when sort of the spree of compromised servers started happening back in October of last year. So at that point, the Capital group that I was involved with that was sort of my introduction into NFTs basically just started shipping me out to different projects that they were getting involved with, just being like, hey, you should probably have someone help you with your Discord. And I started just doing it for free because it was just setting up a Discord, right? Like, I didn't think it would be that difficult. But as the attacks evolved and the phishers and scammers got more sophisticated, honestly, just ended up becoming a full-time job for me. And at that point, there were too many projects that wanted my help for me to help them all. So I started charging, and slowly the prices increased as well as more and more projects started getting hit and more projects needed help.
Amazing. Yeah, no, that's super cool. I'm really curious, what games were you playing, man? Because this sounds intense.
I mean, so it's mostly Minecraft, weirdly enough, but it's a very niche genre of Minecraft where if you are able to kill an enemy combatant, you are able to imprison them inside of an item.
Oh, wow.
So it's sort of like a self-moderated anarchy, almost libertarian, like, wet dream. but the whole point of it is basically to make, like, towns and cities and civilization, enforce your own laws and justice and everything else. But the end result is if there's someone who is malicious, who's, you know, trying to conquer another town or trying to steal people's items, they can get imprisoned or pearled is the term because they're stored in Ender Pearl. And those sentences can range from, you know, you're not allowed to play on the server for a week to you're not allowed to play on the server for a year.
Oh, my gosh.
You're never allowed to play on the server ever again. And then the interesting aspect of it is obviously if you played Minecraft, right? Like, someone can just come to your house and destroy it in like 5 minutes because you can just tear everything down. There's a plugin on the server that lets you reinforce blocks, which means you have to break the block like 50 times before it breaks. So with the combination of those two plugins, you end up creating these prisons called vaults that actually store those physical items of all the criminals. And if it's a vault and it's an item, people can break into the jail and free all the criminals.
Right.
So there are cases where vaults were broken and criminals, thieves, murderers, hundreds of them were released and just descend upon the server and create chaos again. It's really fascinating, and people just honestly take it way too goddamn seriously.
That's incredible. I mean, hey, it got you into, you know, Discord security, and you know, compromising Discord. This is the OG, you know, compromising Discord, you know, supervillain origin story, I guess. But that's amazing. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's been a wild ride. But yeah, and because I really wasn't doing anything else at the time, I was able to really sink my teeth into how you could even set up a Discord to be totally secure, which the journey for that, like, started with just best practices from, like, you know, running gaming servers, which are pretty good, but they're not great, right? The other way to think about it is every single NFT Discord is worth, if you're able to put a fake mint scheme up, somewhere between $100,000 to $250,000, right? So the task essentially is, how do you secure a Discord server that's worth $250,000? And that question, I think, has never really been posed in anywhere on the internet. So the first thing that was sort of developed, discussed, distributed, shared with the community, obviously, was, you know, getting rid of webhooks was the biggest issue in the early days, and limiting perms for moderators. Then the attacker shifted, and they started going after admin-level permissions. You go after people with admin-level permissions, everything else that you set up, all the bots, all the security settings, don't matter. Admins can bypass everything. So then we had to switch from that to doing, you know, cold admins, announcement accounts, basically making it so if anyone does have admin permissions, they can't be phished as easily. Because it doesn't matter who you are or how smart you are or how much security stuff you know, if someone is going to pay me, you know, $200,000 to compromise someone with those level permissions, I can spend a whole lot of time and resources trying to come up with a way to actually fish you, right? So that was sort of the next stage. And then I think kind of the most recent sort of development is that some attackers have been going after well-used, well-known Discord bots. So that required a whole different shift of thinking again, like, how can we limit how much access permission that all these different sort of public Discord bots need? Are there open source alternatives that we can host ourselves? Just things like that. But again, it's just a very interesting space because no one's really sat down and thought about it in a great amount of detail to actually come up with solutions for all of these different attack vectors and how to reduce them on Discord.
Yeah, no, I think putting in those terms really kind of frames the issue, which I think is actually quite insightful, right? Because I think if you think about it as, you know, the financial incentive for doing this, then I think people would go to pretty extreme lengths, you know, and even taking your 200K example, like, even if it costs someone, you know, $100,000 to put together, you know, a complicated phishing scheme or even just, like, you know, paying some hacker on the internet to try to see if they can get someone's login details or something, like, that's worth it, right? Because then they would be able to still capitalize on the massive upside from running that scam. It's fascinating. It's scary. And it's fascinating. And, you know, I mean, you know, the funny thing is, my little Discord server that I have for this podcast was actually compromised. And, you know, luckily no one clicked on the, you know, the link or whatever. But it turns out one of my mods had his account compromised and, you know, ended up having the webhook exploit, which was really unfortunate. And the funny thing is, I was actually planning on reaching out to you to do a Discord audit. And then we kind of hit the bear market, things slowed down. I was like, yeah, no one's hacking anything anyways these days. But the thing is, and what I didn't realize, what I failed to realize at the time was people are still going to be out there, you know, attacking people, especially if they're active, you know, in communities, or if they're just connecting their wallet to the wrong things, or just, you know, having poor practices. And, you know, I think it's, you know, people are still out there doing stuff, even if the returns are not so monumentally large, which is scary.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, again, with the example I was using earlier, if you reduce the amount that you get from a compromised Discord from 100,000 to 25K instead, like, cut it to a fourth, that's still a good amount of money for, honestly, what is a relatively small amount of work.
Yeah.
But it's actually been interesting. The trends I've been seeing lately, the attackers are going after smaller and smaller sized Discords. So before, if you were under, like let's say 4,000 members, you really wouldn't be targeted just because it wasn't worth their time, especially during the bull market. But now, since they've hit so many different servers, I'm seeing servers with even like 1,200 people in them getting compromised. And additionally, sort of the other trend that I've seen, which I hope actually is partly due to me, is instead of focusing on Ethereum-based projects, they've been focusing on Solana-based projects. And a big reason for this is because they're sort of a segregation between the two communities, and not a whole lot of overlap.
Right.
So the information that gets distributed in Ethereum-based projects about like being careful about webhooks, be careful about what permissions your moderators get, really hasn't fully saturated or circulated inside of the Solana community, which is why they're having better success over there at this point.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. That's really unfortunate, actually, because it's a lot of the same thing. It's just on a different network, you know. It's a different blockchain. I mean, that's sad. But definitely have been seeing more and more, you know, exploits happening in Solana. So that does make sense. The one thing that I did want to ask you about in particular, actually, with respect to Discord, was better Discord. And again, I saw that you actually tweeted about this recently. But your stance on better Discord is that it's, well, I should let you explain. I mean, what are your thoughts on better Discord?
Sure. Let me explain what it is first. So better Discord is basically like an extension for your Discord client. You install it and it modifies the Discord client to do a number of different things. The thing that a lot of just general Discord users use it for is it allows you to install custom themes to change how the Discord client looks. The other thing that it allows you to do is it allows you to install plugins that can change mechanics of how Discord works as well. So like one, I actually had a community manager DM me and ask if he could install better Discord specifically for one plugin, which would allow him to create like a multi-column sidebar. So you could have multiple icons like grouped up and they would be bigger. I told him no, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. But I'll get into the reason why. But basically, it's just a sort of a platform that allows you to add in plugins that will change how it works. The first big thing that I need to note is that this is against Discord's terms of service. So the use of better Discord allows and permits Discord to potentially disable your account if you are found using it. They don't normally do this, but it is still an option for them to use at their discretion. So be very, very careful about it if you're using your Discord account for something important, such as NFTs. And then secondly, the more important aspect of it from a security perspective is the way that better Discord works, especially at the plugin level, is it loads these JavaScript scripts that change how Discord looks, how it functions, etc. And that JavaScript can be anything potentially. So if you are installing a Discord plugin and it's malicious, it can just immediately steal your token. Or if you've installed a Discord plugin and it has an update, it's very easy to update these Discord plugins and the update is malicious, it will then steal your Discord token at that point. So from a security perspective, especially if you have elevated perms in an NFT Discord or have anything of importance on your Discord account, definitely do not use better Discord.
Right. So the average person using Discord for NFTs, your recommendation is not to use better Discord. Yeah.
Yep. You're too much of a target. It's just not worth it. If you're just using Discord for gaming, though, and you want it to look pretty, you could probably use it pretty securely, because the worst thing that's going to happen is if they steal your token, they'll sell the token to like someone who wants to do a bot raid, essentially, which is still unfortunate, but it's like you're not going to be losing a whole lot of money, or your community is not going to be losing a whole lot of money off of that. Actually, the other consideration for average users if they lose their token is attackers can go into your Discord settings if you bought Discord Nitro and linked your credit card, and they can just buy a bunch of Nitro codes over and over again. So some people have had like $500 charged their credit card because they got their account compromised. So phishing is still like relatively impactful for regular Discord users as well, but it's just doubly so for NFT users.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. I think that's actually an interesting takeaway, because you know the funny thing is I used to use better Discord. I installed it a while back because you know I did like certain of the functions, like you could edit messages just by double clicking them, and that was huge utility for me. Mm-hmm. And also just organizing everything. But you know, the terms of service thing kind of got me, and I was like, yeah, I really want to lose my Discord account, even though that's not really, you know, massive risk just based on their track record for enforcement. But the bigger thing was just, you know, I did hear someone mention like, hey, you know, there are security issues potentially, and I was like, oh yeah, that's a good point. And I didn't really want to expose myself to that, but I know a lot of people, including, you know, moderators, people with admin perms and stuff, that do use it. And it can't help but feel to me like it's just a matter of time before that gets exploited as well. Again, because there's just such an incentive.
So I also run this thing called a Discord security moderator quiz, which I give out for free for anyone to use for their teams or themselves. And I just added a new question to it. And I was considering whether I should add a better Discord question or not. Mm-hmm. And you've just inspired me to go and write that. I honestly didn't think that many people in the NFT space were using it, but apparently, in your experience, it is a different story. So it's going to be added as a question.
Amazing. Yeah. No, I think it'll help a lot of people to know this actually, because it's sort of something that I see shared around quite a bit. I think when people post a screenshot of their Discord and they have something different, and people are like, "Whoa, like what's that?" And they're like, "That's better Discord." And I've seen that happen probably at least 4 to 5 times. And that's just when I'm sort of sitting there chilling and people kind of come in and say, "Hey, yeah, I use that too. You can't use Discord without better Discord." And it's like, holy shit, this is becoming a thing.
Yeah.
So I do.
That's a good point.
Yeah. It does kind of scare me, because I do feel like it's one of those things that's, again, a matter of time. But I'm, happy to hear that. I think, again, the work that you do is great. It helps a lot of people. So having that in there will definitely be, great. I think for people to know.
One other quick point on the better Discord side too. If you are listening mm-hmm. to this and you had better Discord installed and you want to uninstall it, that's great. But if you want to be secure, just to make sure that your Discord token didn't get leaked through the course of use of better Discord, just change your password after you uninstall it. That will reset your Discord token, invalidating any potential compromise that you might have had.
Nice. Great. That's very actionable. Good stuff. So staying on the vein of, I guess, Discord bots and Discord generally, I do want to ask you about Collabland, because that's something that we touched on before that I think is an interesting sort of point of discussion. But I wanted to ask you, first of all, are there any sort of bots that you think are currently, not really fit for purpose or not really secure, that you think are an issue for people that are running a Discord server, or anything that people should be wary of if they see it in a server?
Meeseeks. Don't use Meeseeks.
No kidding.
Yeah, never use it. At this point, they have both lost my respect as a Discord bot company, but also lost my respect as a company that has also launched an NFT project. So, yeah, Meeseeks has a number of security issues. I can't go into all of them at this point, but the one that I will mention, and the reason why, if you're running an NFT project, that you should never use Meeseeks, is quite simply, they were compromised. Something like 36 different servers were affected with what they called unwanted messages, which led to a fake mint scam. And these Yikes. Were all posted specifically because of Meeseeks, the bot, getting compromised. And the way that it occurred is Meeseeks allows support members on their team access to the dashboard that any Discord server uses. So like if you have Meeseeks in your server, customer support mm-hmm. agents or team members from Meeseeks have access to actually get into your dashboard. They have not specified what team members need to do to get access to this dashboard, but the reason that the compromise happened originally is because one of those team members who was able to had their Discord account phished. That seems like that was the only thing that was necessary to be able to post in any server that had Meeseeks in it, which is terrifying, right?
That's pretty bad. Yeah, that's pretty bad.
The second point is, after this compromise happened that affected a large swath of the NFT community, they never put out a security incident report. They never actually explained publicly what occurred, how it occurred, why, and it's been months now. And then additionally, in private, in one of their AMAs inside their NFT community, they confirmed that backdoor still exists. They didn't get rid of it. It's still there.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. I'm about to uninstall Meeseeks right now.
Yeah. Well, and the other side of it that's kind of insulting, honestly, is like a bunch of people uninstalled Meeseeks in the NFT community once it got compromised because, they didn't want unwanted messages in their own community, mm-hmm. right? But from Meeseeks' perspective, losing you know, 1,000 bot installs inside the NFT community when they get like 1,000 bot installs every like hour. It's not impactful for them, so they just don't really care about it, right? Yeah. So yeah, they are kind of my number one on the shit list at this point.
Yeah, I remember when all this went down, and I remember people were switching to the competitor. I forget the name at the moment.
There's two decent options. There's Probot and there's Dino.
Dino, that's the one that I saw a lot of. Yeah, so I'll probably. Do you think Dino's a good bet? I'm asking for my own sake at this point.
I'm fine with Dino. I still don't think it's the perfect solution. Probot is kind of nice because if you get their premium, you can actually lock the dashboard in Probot to only be specific roles, which is really nice. Mm-hmm. The other sort of terrifying thing about Mi6 is if, number one, you can assign different people to be able to access the Mi6 dashboard, which I think people don't understand how security... how terrible for security that actually is. But if you also have admin permissions or gain admin permissions in any way, you'll get access to the Mi6 dashboard, which allows for potential like permission escalation issues.
Right.
But with Probot, if you get the premium version, you can make it so only specific roles, regardless of permission, can actually access the dashboard instead of everyone with admin, which is nice. But yeah, like this goes back into the other stuff that we were discussing about Discord bots in general, and there's always a potential for any of these third-party bots to get compromised. So I've been trying to switch more and more towards using open-sourced bots that I can host myself.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I'm just looking at my server right now, and it looks like Feline Cat, your colleague, who's helping me do a Discord server audit, has already installed Probot. So it looks like I'm in good shape. This is good.
Yes, Feline is very, very good. So. You're in good hands with
excellent.
Her.
No, she's been great. Okay, well that's good to know. I mean, I think that's good to keep in mind, especially with respect to the whole, you know, Mi6 debacle. Because I remember when that went down, but I think a lot of people may not remember. / you know, next time we see a bull run, it may not so much be a thing. So I definitely do think that's a great takeaway for anyone who, you know, might be working on something or might be involved with a project or, you know, could escalate to, you know, anyone who's, I guess, in charge of a project that they know. So that's super helpful. The other one that I want to ask you about, which I alluded to already, is the whole Collabland thing. And we had a little bit of discussion on this last time. But the idea, you know, a couple questions that come out of this, but, you know, I'll let you speak on, you know, what your thoughts are and everything. The big one for me is, you know, having to verify your assets through something like Collabland. There is this kind of narrative, and I think people all kind of feel this, where, you know, we've seen a lot of compromised bots and things, but if something like Collabland were to be compromised, I feel like everybody in this space is just royally screwed. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, so I don't use Collabland anymore. I have entirely switched to something called Vulkan Authentication, or Vulkan Auth. They were recently acquired by Premint, and it's just a different way to handle NFT verification. Instead of having to go to Collabland and signing some sort of transaction with Collabland, the way that Vulkan operates is you go to OpenSea on your wallet and you change your OpenSea description. So no longer are you interacting with a third party, you're just interacting with OpenSea, which everyone already has to implicitly trust already. So it just reduces a different attack vector, where even if Vulkan authentication was compromised,
yeah,
the attackers couldn't do anything. Functionally, I mean, there's some stuff that they could do depending on how your server was set up, but for the most part, they couldn't do anything super malicious towards your users, which is huge. And as a project owner, like, one of your first goals should be protecting your community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. Yeah.
And the other big issue with Collabland is when it joins your server, it asks for admin permissions, which it does not need. Collabland can function without admin permissions. If you want to know what permissions it needs, you need to dig into their Freshdesk help guide, which is also a terrible place for you to be storing information about a Discord bot, but that's a whole other issue. But yeah, just the fact that Collabland by default asks for admin permissions means if Collabland the bot was compromised, there is so much malicious things that Collabland could actually do just from the Discord bot itself without even talking about having people who try and verify their assets getting sent a malicious approval signature request as well.
Right. So two potential massive issues there. One sort of being the fact that it has admin permissions, if people aren't sort of figuring out exactly what permissions it needs. So it could attack the Discord, or it can attack the individual user if they're assigning malicious signature requests.
Right. And honestly, the other side of it is there are so many communities that already use Collabland who've already installed that bot that it's almost impossible at this stage for Collabland to restrict their own permissions inside of the bot because of how many servers have it installed.
Right.
So it's literally just a ticking time bomb that they can't even fix, which is kind of terrifying. Mm-hmm.
So saying that you don't use Collabland is an interesting thing, because if for certain servers, it's sort of one of these things where if you don't use Collabland and verify your assets, you don't get, you know, some of the benefit that you would otherwise have associated with your NFT, in the sense that, you know, you can't connect, can't verify. How does that sort of work?
Sorry, I meant I don't use Collabland in servers I set up. Uh-huh. I still verify with Collabland, but I'm also lucky enough, or it's not really luck. I've taken the time to actually figure out, you know, what a dangerous transaction looks like before I approve it, right? The issue so much is not the fact that a website's compromised and, you know, sends you a malicious approval transaction. The issue is a lot of people don't check to see what they're actually signing. If you know what you're looking at and what you're doing, it's pretty unlikely that you will sign something that is malicious. So I'm usually fine to verify with Collabland. It's just something that I don't set up in the communities that I work with.
Right. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess Collabland's, it's interesting because it's changed its structure a little bit, where I think previously, a few months ago, you had to sign a transaction every single time you were verifying on Collabland. But now they have the whole thing where it stores your wallets and you just select the one. But I guess that's still not super safe, given that there's still the, you know, Discord server attack vector. And, you know, I think a lot of people kind of have this implicit trust of Collabland, which kind of scares me as well, because I think when you have that feeling towards something, then you're more likely to, you know, sign the occasional pop-up or whatever, because I don't know if it's hopium, but I think a lot of people just have this idea of like, oh, you know, Collabland will never be compromised just because it's so ubiquitous, you know, which I think is kind of dangerous.
Yes. And Collabland has been getting better, right? But it's also kind of just a little too late, right? Because people have already been trained by Collabland that they can just auto-click the yes, I'm on the right website. Yeah, I can auto-click this. Like, the training's already there. The mentality's already there, which is just really, really unfortunate. But yeah, so they have been getting better. But it's just so slow going that it's very frustrating. So right now, I can actually speak a little bit more about why I think in their design process they decided to ask for admin permissions. The way that Collabland used to work is when it joined the server, it would create a channel called Collab Config, which is where you would set up your token gated roles. They switched since then to the dashboard, but the bot still creates the config channel for no apparent reason, which is really annoying. But like, the terrifying thing about that back in the day is anyone who got access to that Collab Config channel was able to add token gated roles. So like, if you screwed up the permissions on the Collab Config channel and normal users could see it, they could just add in the roles that they wanted. So they could just give themselves admin permissions if there was an admin role that was too low.
Big yikes.
Terrifying. Yeah. So like, even from the onset of Collabland, it was not really designed in a way to be super secure. Which is kind of, yeah, again, just terrifying.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why I think it initially asked for admin permissions, is to make sure that it was able to make those channels and modify it. But it's a super lazy way to do it. Like, instead of doing that, you could have just asked for managed channel permissions, and then once the bot was in the server, have it, you know, have a command to make the channel for the config, right? Or even better, just do the entire thing in slash commands that are private. Like, you don't even need a channel, you can just do slash commands. So yeah, it's just a lot of head scratching around Collabland, but I think they've been forced to try and do more secure options because of bots like Vulcanoth. But I just think it's a little too late.
Yeah. No, I mean, they're in so many servers at this point, but I do think that's one of the consequences, I guess, of being so early, right? Is that, you know, people come in and I guess at the time maybe didn't anticipate having such issues, you know, asking for so many permissions. But now it's one of these things where, you know, as the space has moved on, as we've seen how things are getting exploited, it's just caused us to realize that this is, you know, we shouldn't be asking for anything more than we absolutely need. Because security is such a massive issue in this space.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but like CollabLand has been around for a really long time, and they were around before a lot of these NFT discords started getting compromised. So there really wasn't an understanding of how dangerous Discord really was back then necessarily. So, I mean, they do get a little bit of a pass for that, but I'd really like them to see them implement like the same verification system as Vulkan, like as soon as they freaking can.
Yeah.
And the other side of it too, that's just kind of ironic as well, is I didn't use Vulkan Auth for a good amount of time, simply because people hadn't heard of them, right? There was no trust, no implicit trust there with community members. But now that Premint has acquired them, everyone knows who Premint is. So having Premint involved has gotten rid of that trust issue for Vulkan Auth, in my opinion, which makes it the superior choice at this stage.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Awesome, man, that's great. I do want to get into some practical tips for people who are listening and who are active in the space, because I do think, you know, whilst I think a lot of these things are good for people to know, and I think good for people in particular, you know, who are managing Discord servers, I do want to ask, you know, about what you think are good safety practices for, you know, people that are just in the space. And I think the one that I kind of want to start with, because it's one that people kind of talk about a lot, is, you know, basically how people transact with their cold storage wallet. So a lot of people, you know, I know people that mint using their Ledger, which I think is crazy. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Like, you know, I think obviously best practice is, you know, you kind of just want to park your assets in Ledger, and you're not really interacting with smart contracts unless absolutely necessary with your Ledger. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think everyone should have a couple different wallets, right? You should not be using one wallet for everything. The first wallet, the most insecure one, is going to be your hot wallet. That is what you should be using to interact with mints, anything degen, like anything that is not super high value, but is something that you have to interact with, like contracts or whatever else, or whatever else you're doing. The next layer down is something that's called a warm wallet. And that's more of a general crypto term. I don't really see it used a whole lot in the space, but the way to describe it is, unlike a hot wallet, which is going to be on your main computer that you're using all the time on your MetaMask, a warm wallet should be something that you only open up occasionally, right? And most of the time it's not connected, not on a device that you're necessarily using. So an easy way to do this is, most people have a, you know, a desktop computer and then a laptop computer. So put your warm wallet on your laptop. Only open it up when you want to do certain types of transactions. And those types of transactions could potentially be staking, if it's something that you might have to unstake or switch often. That's usually where I would recommend that you do transactions with OpenSea. So if you mint something on your hot wallet, the floor price increases and you want to go sell it. I say that the floor price increases because, like, if you mint something for like 0.002 ETH and then it rises 0.004 ETH, like, you're probably not going to care enough to move it to your warm wallet to sell it. You could probably sell it on your hot wallet at that point. But anything that, like, any NFTs that you actively want to sell, either that you've minted or potentially from your vault wallet that we're going to get to next, transfer your warm wallet, interact with OpenSea there to actually sell it. And yeah, just sort of like any transactions that are more valuable that you want to be a little bit more secure about should probably happen on your warm wallet. And then the last one is the cold wallet, which should be obviously like a Ledger or something like that, where you really just store things. And yeah, you shouldn't be using that to mint. You should use your warm or hot wallet to mint instead, or interact with any contracts. The only exception to that potentially is if you need to stake something for a long time and it's worth a lot of money, you might want to do that from a ledger. But that's really, it's kind of up to you and like how much you're securing and how much it means to you. And honestly, like potentially you could have two ledgers too. There's no reason you only need to use one of them. Those are like the three wallets you probably should have. And just to clarify for people too, if you're a little confused about how to make a new wallet, in MetaMask, you can create as many wallets as you want. You just click on it and then you go to the profile picture on the right hand side, and then you go down and you just click the create account button. And that new account is a new wallet that you can use. It's separate from the first wallet that you created when you created your MetaMask. Any contract that you interact with on that second wallet will not interact with your address from your first wallet or account, but it is all linked to your seed phrase. So if your seed phrase gets compromised, all of the wallet addresses, all the accounts in your MetaMask would be compromised. So just never give out your seed phrase. But yeah, that second account that we just walked through how you create it, that could also be considered what we call a burner wallet. So off of your core hot wallet, you can also create burner wallets, which you can use for really, really degen plays, just so you don't expose anything else in your first account to something that could be malicious.
Yeah. No, that's all great tips. The one thing I wanted to clarify on that, when you say two ledgers, are you referring to two physical devices or just two separate wallets using one ledger device?
I'm talking about actually two different physical ledgers. You could potentially have two wallets on ledger two. That's great. And also something that I don't necessarily advise, but it is an option, is you can actually have two different seed phrases and basically just like wipe your ledger and restore from the old seed phrase, right? And like swap between the two seed phrases. I don't recommend doing that because it opens up the possibility that you lose your seed phrase of your secondary account and then can't restore it, which would suck. So depending again how much money you're storing, how much it means to you, it might be worthwhile to get two actual physical ledgers.
That's fascinating. And so what is the benefit, I guess, of using two ledgers, given that obviously I guess the main risk that at least I can think of is if you lose your ledger device or if someone, you know, manages to compromise your ledger device in some way. But what's the benefit of having two separate devices?
This basically goes into the core concept of everything that I'm talking about here, and that's segregation of risk, right? The more accounts you have, the less is at risk if any individual one gets compromised.
Right.
So splitting up your accounts even more means that there's less of a chance of you losing everything. Now, the downside to that is if you have more accounts, more things in play, you have more backups that you need to make, and there's more of a potential that you lose the backups, or you lose the ledger device or whatever else. So you just have to really consider how much money you're protecting, how much it means to you, how much inconvenience you want in your life in the sake of security, and come up with a plan that works for you. Like, there is no one-size-fits-all solution for everyone.
Yep. No, that makes a lot of sense. And it's funny because there are some people in the space who, you know, who've never had their wallets compromised, as far as I'm aware. I mean, a buddy of mine, Sneaky Ninja Pants, comes to mind. I think he transacts completely off of one single wallet. I think he might have cold storage where he, you know, puts the majority of his, I guess, profits and things. But I mean, he has a hidden folder that has, I think, over 1,000 NFTs. His main folder has, you know, certainly over 1,000. It's nuts. You know, it's a scary proposition. But, you know, truthfully, I think a lot of people don't follow the best practices, even though they know them. And, you know, I'm guilty of this too. I kind of end up using one wallet most of the time. And, you know, I have a couple that are private that, you know, I usually mostly use just because I don't like people tracking my wallet and such. But it is a very interesting thing. You know, I have cold storage. What scares me is always when people say that, you know, they're literally just using one. But that happens, you know, quite a bit more than one would suspect.
Yeah, I mean, so like the other side of it too is it's not a problem until it's a problem, and once it's a problem, everything's gone. Which I mean brings to mind like the Martin Shkreli stuff, right? Where he downloaded a porn torrent, which had malware in it, and everything he had is gone now, right?
Oh, yikes.
So, functionally, if you're using one wallet and you kind of know what you're doing, you're probably not going to interact with malicious smart contracts. You're not going to give up, you know, your private keys or your seed phrase. But the thing that's terrifying is, again, additional attack vectors. If you ever install malware on that computer accidentally, you're just screwed. Honestly, this goes back to Discord security as well, right? Like, you can be in a Discord that hasn't been compromised yet, and they can say that they're the most secure place ever, but it's not really a question of, you know, if they're actually secure. It's a question of, like, when are they going to get compromised, mostly, unless they've actually worked with an auditor that knows what they're doing. It's the best practices are there for a reason. And again, if you're new to NFTs and you're just throwing in like $100 or whatever, and that's not a whole lot of money to you, you probably don't need cold storage because you're dealing, you know, with stakes that are not as important to you. So like it's honestly like I view it as sort of a sliding scale as it gets to a percentage of what your net worth is, for how much people actually care.
Yep. No, that makes, I think that makes total sense. Awesome. And I guess the last big thing is, well, two last things that I have. One is there's this concept right now of, you know, minting from contract with this whole free mint meta. And people have this narrative that's been spun quite a bit that, you know, it makes a lot more sense from a security perspective if you're minting things directly from contract rather than minting from a website. And I think that's the assumption or understanding simply because websites can sort of have you click a button and you don't really know what processes are running as a result of clicking that button versus if you go to, you know, Etherscan and you're sort of, you know, plugging in variables and minting from contract directly, it just feels a bit more safe. Do you have any thoughts on that at all?
Yeah, so websites can be malicious. I'm more concerned about websites that are specifically sent to me rather than ones that are like public projects that are doing a free mint. If it's a website that's specifically sent to you in a link or something, potentially like they could get your IP address and start, you know, figuring out personal information about you. But public websites from a public project with a free mint, I don't think are necessarily going to be too malicious. Mm-hmm. You do need to know functionally or relatively what you're doing, which quite frankly, if you are at the point in your journey in the space where you're actually able to mint from an Etherscan smart contract, you probably know enough to know if something's fishy or off. So I usually don't have too many reservations about minting off of a project's mint page. I always just make sure that I triple check, number one, the Discord for the official link of the project to make sure that it's the same as the minting site. Number two, the Twitter profile of the project to make sure that the minting page is the same, that the one that I clicked. And then number three, I also, if they have it set up, the OpenSea and check to make sure that the website's the same on the OpenSea collection as well. If you triple check and it's the actual project's website, that's pretty good. So then your next concern is, you know, whether it's a rug pull or not. And there's kind of two ways that you can do a rug pull. One, the website itself could just be a wallet drainer, which you can tell pretty quickly when you click to go, when you press the button to actually go and mint, it will tell you one of two things. One, it will ask you to just transfer ETH to a wallet address, which doesn't actually interact with a smart contract, so it won't actually mint anything. Or number two, it's going to ask you to approve or transfer another NFT, which if you just check the data tab on MetaMask, you can figure that out pretty quickly. So I don't really think, as long as you like are aware and well knowledgeable in the space, minting off of the website could really be that dangerous. The other consideration that I like to give too is if you're working with a smart contract that has some sort of Merkle tree set up for like whitelist minting and everything else, Minting from the smart contract with Merkle trees is really difficult. And that could potentially lead you to, having a reverted transaction and losing a little bit of money on gas. I don't think that fully answered your question, but it's kind of I kind of feel like it's a non-issue essentially.
Okay. No, I mean, that's helpful to hear. I mean, I think, because I was just curious because, again, you know, I think we get these narratives from time to time where people have this idea of, you know, this is safe and this is not. And I'm always curious, you know, really digging deep into it, you know, whether or not those things are true. So that's an interesting thing. And I think obviously the actionable security things that you brought up are good, and checking the website and stuff, and distinction between links that are sent to you versus, you know, going to the actual website makes total sense. And the last one that I have is just, you know, what do you think is the biggest risk, I guess, at the moment for the average NFT trading degen that would sort of, you know, is the best thing to keep in mind / mitigate as one is going through this space?
I mean, at this point, it's really just the wallet drainers. That is pretty much the meta that fishers are using at this point. So just always check your transaction before you approve it, even if you're on a trusted website. And the other thing that I like to advise people, everyone is always really concerned once you start opening up the Etherscan and looking through the blockchain, because everything looks confusing and there's a bunch of numbers and math and everything. If you're scared to do that, number one, don't be. But number two, if you're still scared, what I recommend is every single time that you do a transaction in your MetaMask, just take 30 seconds to look through all the different tabs on MetaMask. Read the stuff. You don't even have to understand it. Just read it. Make sure you know what it looks like. So if you ever see something during a mint in the future that doesn't match what you've seen before, you can stop and you can go ask someone, hey, does this look suspicious to you? Just having like that in your memory, what it's supposed to look like, can save you in the future.
Yep. And I think that's a great, that's really helpful, because I think a lot of people have this whole thing of like, oh, you know, like, how do you tell if a, you know, signature request is valid, or if this thing that popped up out of MetaMask is good or whatever. But I think that's right. I think it's the pattern recognition and sort of knowing what legitimate things look like. And therefore, if there's anything, you know, that kind of throws you off, that looks different, at least you have that sort of little red flag that kind of instinctively pops up, which could save you a lot of money and pain and suffering.
Yep. And I mean, that also goes hand in hand with just never give in to the FOMO. Even if you get like a full ETH flip off of something, right? Is that worth potentially losing everything else in your wallet?
Definitely not.
Usually not.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously depending on wallet size, but
yeah, no, that makes total sense. And, man, that's all I have. But I mean, to be honest with you, I there's way more I could ask you. I feel like, you know, it'll be, but this is, you know, I wanted to focus in on things that are actionable for people that, you know, could have an actual impact on people and maybe even save someone from, you know, something shitty happening to their account. So really appreciate your time, man, like as always. And you know, I hope we keep this conversation going. I'm sure, you know, when we see the next bull run and people are sort of feeling a lot of FOMO and feeling a lot of excitement and sort of just coming in and minting everything in sight, we'll also see, you know, a big uptick in activity that, you know, is malicious and sort of scammy and stuff. And so people like you really do, you know, a huge service for the space. And I appreciate everything you do, man.
Thanks. And it was a pleasure coming on.
Hell yeah. Well, we'll definitely keep the conversation going, my man. Thanks again.
All right. Have a good rest of your day.